is there some way, anyway, that we can go forward with any of the legislation that the governor has proposed?
Lawmakers are still uncertain about what's happening during the special session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 12th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes, filling in for Lori Townsend. Also tonight, solving the icebreaker problem.
See, and that's what I call, Mr. Chairman, a bullshit answer. Military service.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm talking about moving ice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Whether the legislature will take action in the special session remains uncertain. The House is divided over whether or not to try to overturn Governor Bill Walker's vetoes of permanent fund dividend money or other budget items. And it's not clear whether there are enough votes to pass any of the bills Walker called them into session to consider. House Speaker Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault says he and his colleagues are asking different questions about what the House can actually do.
Is there some way, anyway, that we can go forward with any of the legislation that the governor's proposed, or are we just continuing to spin our wheels and spend more state money on a futile effort?
Walker has proposed six bills, most related to possible new taxes. One would restructure permanent fund earnings to pay for state government on a more sustainable basis. The House is scheduled to hold another floor session tonight as it seeks a way to move forward. Not only is the Coast Guard low on icebreakers, but the sole heavy breaker still on the job is due to retire before a replacement can hit the water. That icebreaker gap was the subject of a hearing in the U.S. House today. The hearing turned testy when Congressman Don Young pressed the Coast Guard to consider leasing an icebreaker from the private sector. The company's owner happens to be a big contributor to Young's campaign. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Everybody on the Coast Guard and Maritime Transportation Subcommittee seemed to agree that the nation needs icebreakers. A Senate bill already includes $1 billion for one icebreaker, but shipbuilding would take a decade. The country would likely have no heavy icebreaker for 3 to 6 years, hampering potential ship traffic in the far north. Alaska Congressman Don Young confronted the Coast Guard witness with a suggestion, and the hearing took a very specific turn.
I'll get the elephant out of the room here in a sense. During the shell activity, there were anchor layer ice-breaking capable ships. Is that correct?
As Young and others added details, it began to sound like they were talking about the IVIC. That's a huge heavy tug owned by the shipbuilding firm Edison Schwest and built specifically for Shell's Arctic work. Young wanted to know why the Coast Guard couldn't use that ship to break ice.
Would you be interested in that, Admiral, if that was to take place? I know you've had the proposal on your desk, by the way. It's already been laid on your desk, and it's an automatic no. Why?
Coast Guard Vice Commandant Charles Michel says his boss checked out that ship in person, but the admiral says the vessel is not suitable.
And I can go into the reasons
why,
sir.
Wait a minute, stop. You think so, but if the shipbuilder said that I can take and meet your requirements with the bow it has now, tungsten steel, heavy.
The admiral wasn't budging. He says all Coast Guard icebreakers have to operate as military ships, asserting national sovereignty.
Sir, our current opinion is that ship is not suitable for military service without substantial refit.
See, and that's what I call, Mr. Chairman, a bullshit answer. Military service.
Thank the gentleman.
I'm talking about moving ice.
All right, let's get into that if you don't mind, Admiral. Let's go on
the chairman of the subcommittee, Representative Duncan Hunter of California, took up Young's line of questioning, challenging the admiral to explain why it couldn't use a private icebreaker. Young never named the ship, And in a hallway after the hearing, he would only say that ships are available.
So what ship is available?
Pardon?
What is
I don't
ship
know, but there are...
You mentioned one that...
There are ships available that could be used, and I'm just saying let's use them.
Young's spokesman later confirmed that the specific ice-capable ship Young was describing was the Ivik. The 360-foot tug is worth about $200 million, according to trade publications. It presumably has some spare time since Shell canceled its Arctic project. Ivik's owner, Edison Schwest, is a major source of campaign contributions to Young. The Schwest family and employees have contributed more than $250,000 to Young over the past decade, and Steve Lindbeck, a Democrat running for Young's seat, has already made an issue of it. Young's spokesman, Matt Shuckerow, says Young was just using the Ivik as an example, a possible solution to the icebreaker gap.
The Coast Guard says there's only one available option, and that's building a new ship. It's Congress's responsibility to look at all options. And as the congressman has said, you know, time and time again, he believes that we should look at everything on the table.
Shuckerow says Young would be happy to talk to other U.S. shipbuilders. A spokesman for Edison Schwest did not respond to phone messages. By the way, if the name Ivik rings a bell, this was the tug pulling the ill-fated Shell rig that went aground near Kodiak in 2012. Reporting from the U.S. House, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, using spray paint to connect kids to culture.
I want that to be in your face. I want it to be huge. You can't deny it. It's there. You know what I mean? That's why I use this. It's my voice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Under a new U.S. Senate bill, tribes across the country would have new opportunities to reclaim lost artifacts. The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony, or STOP Act, would prevent the export of cultural and religious items. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
It's time to make sure that items that are deeply religious or deeply connected to individual tribes are respected, are not sold on the auction block.
That's Martin Heinrich, the junior senator from New Mexico, who introduced the STOP Act to the Senate. The act is an extension of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, which was passed in 1990. NAGPRA prohibited the sale of Native American cultural or religious items or ceremonial remains, but did not prevent the export of these items. That legal loophole created a market for collectors to purchase these items overseas, most notably in Europe.
I think it just didn't foresee at the time the fact that once an item covered under NAGPRA leaves the United States, that there's no real way to prosecute it under NAGPRA.
Heinrich introduced the STOP Act on Wednesday with Southwest Native American leaders and says that he hopes to reach out to more tribes to gather support and insight for the bill.
We really want to hear from the entire Native world about how their stories, how they've been impacted, and hear from them on how we can make this better.
Aaron Leggett is the curator of Alaska History and Culture at the Anchorage Museum. He says that the STOP Act would help with Alaska Native cultural repatriation, but the impact wouldn't be huge.
With the exception of maybe some items in Southeast Alaska, I don't think that it would. There's a few cases here and there. There have been pieces that have been sold at auction. I know there were several Yupik masks that were sold for record amounts of money.
Leggett says, in the past, Alaska Native groups have organized the recovery of cultural items themselves.
Some of the communities have also either privately, quietly went to these auctions and purchased items or had wealthy benefactors purchase them and essentially repatriate them to the people. Or in some cases, they've even went to the donors before they put them in the auctions and explained to them why these items really shouldn't be on the open market.
Leggett says the STOP Act would aid the recovery of lost artifacts. However, he says Southwest tribes have suffered the most from this type of cultural loss, and not really Alaskan natives. Senator Heinrich says reception for the bill has been almost unanimously positive, and he has reached out to Alaska delegates specifically to help push the bill through.
I do a lot of work with Senator Murkowski. We're both on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, so she was one of the first senators that we sent a discussion draft to. So they are going through that now, and we're looking forward to finding out if it's something we can work together on.
In addition to banning the export of cultural items, the STOP Act increases penalties under NAGPRA from 5 years to 10 years for selling unlawfully obtained cultural items, and allows for a 2-year amnesty period where items can be repatriated to tribes with no legal penalty. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Efforts to eradicate the invasive aquatic plant Elodia have had mixed results. Herbicides are being considered in Fairbanks, while on the Kenai Peninsula, the plant is all but gone. To date, the effects of the plant on Alaska's environment have been measured in terms of impact on freshwater resources, but now economists at the Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER, are working to analyze the implications of the plant's spread to salmon habitat. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Someone, at some time in the past, dumped a goldfish tank into Chena Slough in Fairbanks, and the results have been alarming. Elodia, a typical household aquarium plant, is commonly seen in fish bowls, but it has gone wild in Alaska. Tobias Schwarr is an ICER economist.
This plant is really adapting to Alaska conditions, and it's been found in many places to survive even in ice.
Schwarr is neither a botanist nor a fisheries biologist. He works with data in a cramped ICER office in Anchorage surrounded by computer monitors. Schwarr is mapping Elodia's progress, tracking its spread from one Alaska lake to another as part of a research project into possible impacts to salmon. Elodia grows so fast in Alaska that it has been blamed for destroying fish habitat in some places, like Chena Slough, where grayling habitat has diminished because the heavy, matted masses of Elodia absorb the nutrients fish thrive on. That's chilling news to an industry that depends on freshwater lakes and streams to replenish its salmon supply. Spawning can be impaired as the density of Elodia increases and crowds out fish habitat. But Schwarr says there are many unknowns. He says there could be another scenario.
On the other side, it has positive effects in terms of it increases productivity. There could be more prey for certain salmon species. There's anecdotal evidence that it enhances this little water snail that cohos and whitefish like to eat.
The plant may provide a snack for coho, but it can affect the oxygen levels critical for fish survival. Elodia first showed up in Eyak Lake in Cordova in 1982. It probably hitched a ride out on the floats of an air taxi, later appearing in Sand Lake and Lake Hood in Anchorage. Schwarr's Elodia pathway map will help float plane pilots as well because they don't want to land on lakes choked with the stuff. Three lakes on the Kenai were infested with the plant but have been rated cleared as of this summer, according to Heather Stewart, the state's invasive plant coordinator. Efforts to get rid of it mechanically in Chena Slough were not as successful, she says, and an herbicide assault will be next.
Right now, we're hashing out the environmental assessment for the work to propose to use Floridone in Chena Lake, Chena Slough, and Tocheket Slough in Fairbanks.
Schwarr hopes his ICER research will help DNR resource managers stop the spread of the plant. He says there is an interesting slant to the Elodia story in that Alaska's Elodia may become a separate variety.
Researchers have tried to grow Elodia from the Kenai Lakes in the lab and used their methods to grow the Elodia at much higher temperatures than found in Alaska, and the Elodia did not grow as the researchers expected, and it turned out that once they dropped the temperature in those tanks where they grew the Elodia all of a sudden took off.
Meanwhile, Elodia has rooted in remote Alexander Lake in the Matanuska Sioux Sidna area. Stewart says eradication efforts could begin this summer. Alexander Lake also hosts invasive northern pike, a fish which seems to like Elodia, Schwarer says, giving Matsu a 1-2 invasive punch.
Humans are the main drivers and distributors of this.
The spread of the plant is blamed on float planes or boats as they travel from one lake to another. He says the cost of invasive species eradication in the lower 48 is in the billions of dollars every year. And conversely, the invasive problem is just getting started in Alaska, and that could bring opportunities for a new industry based on prevention and response to invasives. Schwarer's research data could be useful in that respect as well, he says. The ICER Elodia data is expected to be published sometime next year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A petition from Bristol Bay Area Sport Fishing Lodges has reached the top desk of the U.S. Coast Guard. At issue in the petition are new rules that Western Alaska lodge owners say will make it nearly impossible for them to hire local guides. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
The new Coast Guard rules require fishing guides to get 90 days of sea time per waterway to get a restricted license to guide on that particular waterway. Lodge owners argue that requiring that much time per waterway is unreasonable given the nature of sport fishing in Western Alaska. So last month, Alaska's congressional delegation signed a letter asking the Coast Guard to change those rules. In a subcommittee hearing June 15th, Senator Dan Sullivan brought up the issue with the commandant of the Coast Guard. Admiral Paul Zukunft said, basically, he's working on it.
On the record, I am revisiting that very same regulatory process. I have fished with those guides up there.
Yeah.
The provision that concerns me the most is the 360 days for a new entrant to be able to enter into this world of work. I recognize the seasonality that goes with that as well. So I will take it upon myself and with my staff to work with yours to come with a common sense solution to this problem set.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we were surprised with that, but it was certainly welcome.
That's Bud Hodson. He owns Tick Chick Narrows Lodge, one of nine lodges petitioning the Coast Guard to change the rules. He says the admiral's response sounded promising.
The admiral also made a comment that he was familiar with the guiding up here. It sounds like he's been up here as a client fishing. So, yeah, we're just waiting to hear back and how they treat our petition, and hopefully they accept it and take the rules back to the way they were.
What Hodson and his coalition want is for Western Alaska to go back to the previous regs that required 120 days of sea time on any inland freshwater to be able to guide on any inland waters in Western Alaska. Hodson is pretty confident the Coast Guard will see reason to give Western Alaska that exemption. If that doesn't happen, he says, it's only a matter of time before some lodges will have to go out of business.
You know, they gave us a time period, a phase-in time period. When that's gone, if they don't fix this, then, you know, the guides that will get a restricted license would be limited to one watershed. And that's going to be, you know, impossible for people to go from different jobs, different lodges, different regions. And I don't think we'll be able to find enough guides to fill our guiding rosters.
Hodson hopes the Coast Guard could change the rule back by this winter, so that guides who qualify under the old set of rules could get their licenses by next summer. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
In In a classroom in downtown Fairbanks, there are 20 computers hooked up to new 3D printers within the University of Alaska's Community and Technical College, or CTC. Teachers there believe it is going to be a game changer for Alaska to print objects at home instead of buying them from an outside source. KUAC's Robin visited the lab to find out if it's true.
So that thing you ordered online a week ago, for which you paid a lot to ship to Alaska, you're still waiting, huh? Now, imagine that you went to your household 3D printer, downloaded a pattern for the thing you wanted, pushed a button, and the item appeared. No waiting for the mail, no shipping costs.
I think that printers in general, the 3D printers, are very in line with the Alaskan like duct tape mentality, or like do it yourself or fix it.
That's Joel Sturm. He's a program assistant for the Drafting and Design Technology Department at CTC, the downtown branch of the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
And it's also us being kind of separated from the rest of the world. Like, everyone knows about shipping costs and or like waiting longer or anything like that. So the digital inventory and delocalized manufacturing, I think, is going to be a really big part of it in Alaska.
He manages the lab where 3D printers turn spools of plastic into practical items.
What this looks like right now, it's got just a hot nozzle, like it's really hot, and then it's got a plastic spool feeding into it. So as it feeds in, it melts it and squirts it out the nozzle. If you were doing a soda can, it would just be a series of draw a circle, go up a little bit, draw a circle, go up a little bit. It's just cutting whatever you have into layers and then drawing each one individually.
Adam McDermott is a teacher for a 3D modeling and printing class in the lab.
Now, it's pretty exciting to come into class, and the first thing I get here, and the printers are already going. We have a couple students who are really on it, and they want to get going, not wait. And then as the class fills up, everyone starts talking and looking at stuff and oohing and on. It's pretty cutting edge.
He believes 3D printing will be a paradigm shift. As Alaskans get used to it, there will be a 3D printer in everyone's home, kind of like a toaster or a coffee maker. And we will use them like a Star Trek replicator to make whatever we need. And according to Bill Fox, another teacher, the costs of the technology are coming down. The little 6x6-inch printers in this room are about $700 each, but kits start at $300.
Well, it's going to change everybody's life, because on a computer you can design a part that you need or an object that you need and print it and have it ready to go quicker than you can have it sent off. This is a game changer for everything.
Fox makes toys and models out of the 3D printing, also parts for his motorcycle and old cars. McDermott makes parts for his chainsaw, and they've seen the students invent whatever they can imagine.
And he was showing me his shoelaces his wife made him, that he put a magnet in them, so now he doesn't have to tie his shoes anymore. They just snap shut. It's pretty excellent. He walks around with a 3D printed pair of shoelaces.
Joel Sturm says the characteristics of 3D printing make it perfect for custom medical prostheses, artificial body parts.
One of their advantages is that complexity is free. It doesn't matter if you're printing a box or if you're printing a box that has a whole bunch of in ornate shapes and things and text on it. It's going to take the printer about the same amount of time, since it's just doing it layer by layer. And complexity is free, and the anatomy matters. We can all have our own individual thing now. We can have the thing that is tailored to us.
So that thing you ordered a week ago, soon you'll be manufacturing it yourself. I'm Robin, reporting in Fairbanks.
Spray paint is often associated with illegal scrawling on underpasses and alleyways, but the Anchorage Museum is using it as a tool to connect kids to culture. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
Artist Dwayne Manuel stands before his 7-foot painting of a raven outside of the Anchorage Museum, traffic streaming by. The dark blue of the plywood structure he's transforming shines through the black spray paint, highlighting the bird's feathers. Its body is empty.
So there's this area right here. I kind of feel like maybe I should add something there. I'm not too sure what. You know what I mean? Just to kind of push this a little further.
Manuel is Ankakmal Atam from the Salt River Reservation in Arizona. He chose to paint a raven because it's a common symbol in Alaska, and he wanted to paint something realistic. Manuel is a formally trained painter who's also designed shoes for Nike. But one of his favorite mediums is graffiti art.
I want that to be in your face. I want it to be huge. You can't deny it. It's there. You know what I mean? That's why I use it. It's my voice.
Many of his works incorporate the patterns and symbols of autumn basket weaving, an art form the women of his family have carried on for generations. Men don't weave, but he says his mother gave him permission to use the patterns in his work. He also uses it as a way to teach youth about their culture.
Well, I had a lot of students of mine like question, like, "Oh, well, what is that?" And then opens up that door for conversation, you know, dialogue about, "Oh, this is a basket design from our people." And
that's part of the motivation behind the Anchorage Museum's Urban Intervention Street Art Program. It aims to connect local youth to the museum and help them develop new ways to express themselves in a positive setting. During the day-long session, 12 at-risk youth examine objects from the museum's collection, learn about Athabascan culture, and then incorporate images of the cultural objects into their own street art. Manuel and fellow artist Renee Strike One Garcia were invited to the museum because they teach similar programs in Arizona. Local artist Ariel Obisco Taylor is also teaching there. As Manuel considers what to add to his raven, Garcia, of the Tohono O'odham, uses cans of white and light blue to paint mountains on other sections of the board.
You know, we play off of each other. What do you think about this, or what do you think about that? And then it helps bring a bigger piece together, and that's what we're trying to do here right now.
Garcia has no formal training, but started making street art in the late 1980s in Arizona as soon as he could get his hands on spray paint. He says it's a vital form of expression for people of all ages. Even hastily scrawled words and names are ways people try to have their voices heard and be acknowledged. But for artists to really get their ideas across, Garcia says they have to have places to legally paint and a host of technical skills.
Different techniques just take practice, and it really comes down to, like, you know, the thin line. You just have to constantly learn the pressure points on the can and the valve system that's on it.
Meanwhile, Manuel is still pondering his raven. How can he express himself in the work? He adds water symbols to the bird's body because they come from his culture, but he can't really explain why. As he stares at the board, he talks about who he is, his defining sense of humor, and he finds inspiration.
That's why I call me Dwayne Onsano, because my joking. Another thing is, too, I'm from the Coyote Clan at home, and I just had an idea. You know, the trickster's just like the raven, and Joker's just like the raven.
Within moments, he has cans of black and red paint in his hands. He covers over the spirals with coyote tracks from his mother's basket patterns. In an instant, he transforms the raven into an expression of connections, commonalities, and shared cultures. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Robin in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Ann Hillman produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.